The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, good afternoon and welcome to the show, everybody. We've got another interesting week of Capital Thinking. Later in the show, we're going to look at what's going on in airport security since the Christmas bomber. We're talking to one of the leading providers of detection equipment. We're also going to be taking a look at an interesting case out of Russia of a man being held long-term against his will in the fight to free him. But with the first 2 weeks of the new year having already brought some political bombshells, we are bringing in some talent off the bench to talk about developments in the race to control Washington in the 2010 election cycle, and that's where we'll focus our show on to begin. Our guests today are Vince Ferlicci, a former senior advisor to now-retiring Connecticut Senator Chris Dodd, Democrat, and also Mark Ross, who's with Second Six, a grassroots communications firm in Washington, D.C., and a decorated political veteran on the right-hand side of the aisle who, in his recent past, worked for Congressman Tom DeLay when he was the House Majority Leader for Republicans. So, Vince and Mark, welcome to the show. How are you guys today?
Great. Happy to be here, Kevin.
Good. Well,
Thanks for having us.
Let's start off with you, Vince, and sort of give us the lay of the land from the Democratic perspective. We have had a lot of retirements, Dorgan and Dodd announcing their retirements shortly after the new year. Senator Reid has had perhaps his least favorite week of the last couple of years on a personal level as he deals with the controversy over remarks he made about President Obama when he was running for election. How are Democrats doing in their fight to control the Senate in 2010 and beyond?
Well, as the old line goes, you know, the question to Mrs. Lincoln. So besides that, Mrs. Lincoln, how was the play, I guess, is the way I should respond to that kind of introduction. I think, obviously, it's a challenging landscape for Democrats, and I think there's always the ghost of the founders, right, who created this government to have an executive, a legislative, and a judicial branch that would all check each other. And I think historically, whenever you have one party control both the legislative and executive branches, it becomes very difficult to govern. And I think we're seeing that difficulty being reared upon the Democrats right now, upon my party, as an embarrassment of riches of controlling everything. And I think that my only comment, I think directly to your comment about Dodd and Dorgan, is I would just tell people not to read too much, I think, into correlating those decisions on the environment as much as I think they were personal decisions for both those senators, both being in places, I think, looking at next chapters in their lives after 25, 30 years of service. So definitely factors in both those races that are part of the environment, but I wouldn't discount the personal sort of factors as well.
Well, Mark, let's turn to you. You work in the grassroots communications area, and therefore you probably have your finger on the pulse of a lot of the voter angst and outright anger that they have towards incumbents, regardless of their party. One of the things that's interesting is that the ratings for congressional incumbents are very low, and obviously Democrats are in the majority, but when they ask party affiliation, public opinion of Republicans is very low as well. It hasn't really ticked up. So what are Republicans going to do to offer a legitimate alternative to Democrats this election season?
Yeah, it is an interesting phenomenon. You have a situation where I think there's a lot of voters out there that are mad at generally elected officials, regardless of party. And I think a lot, as you alluded to, a lot of people I work with, I see a lot of enthusiasm that I didn't see in 06 and 08. I mean, as you know, a lot of Republicans stayed home in 08, and very few true activist-type Republicans are very enthusiastic about McCain on top of the ticket, and I think that has really hurt, and that's kind of transpired. In some ways, there's been a bit of, I think, a hangover. Like in 06 and 08, the Republicans were the target, and they were the easy folks to kind of get out of the way. Now the Democrats are kind of in there, and you're seeing a lot of candidates. I think you're seeing a lot of business folks, people that don't have a traditional political background running for office. I know the guys at the House NRCC are doing a really good job of trying to recruit small business type folks that don't really have that kind of background, can kind of speak to real world experience as kind of the ideal candidate going into that. So I think you're going to hear a lot more about experience issues as opposed to party identification going forward.
Well, there's a hot race going on right now. It's kind of fascinating, and that's this Senate race up in Massachusetts where Scott Brown, a guy who's not held office before, actually, I take it back, he's a state senator, I apologize, but kind of an unknown Republican running against Martha Coakley, the Democratic Attorney General, to take over the seat that was held by the Kennedy family for essentially the last 45, 50 years. The Republicans are really closing strong. So, Vince, let's start with you and tell us, what do Democrats have to do to not just squeak out a win there, but to convince larger political players that that race isn't indicative of a national trend?
Well, I think it's exactly what Mark is seeing through his work in the grassroots of the Republican activists, is that there has to be some additional excitement created among the Democratic base. Is a special election on a cold Tuesday in January in the state of Massachusetts, and the turnout's going to be minuscule. And those that are excited or angry or whatever they're feeling are going to decide this race. And I think if my biggest complaint about my party right now is I think they've done a bad job at explaining all the different things that are going to help real people with their lives with health care reform that's being proposed. I think that that obviously, because they haven't come to a final agreement, that they haven't been able to go out and sell the product because they're still on the assembly line. But nonetheless, there are parts of this healthcare plan regarding redlining and pre-existing conditions that are very popular across the political spectrum that are going to be in this car when it comes off the line. I don't know why they aren't talking about that more. If this is truly going to be a referendum on healthcare, as I think the Republicans are partly making in Massachusetts, then it would behoove the Democrats to talk more about the one, two, or three things that are popular that are going to be in healthcare reform.
All right, and Mark, let's put the shoe on the other foot. What do you have to do here to see Scott Brown either win or have a moral victory that translates into grassroots support in other elections across the country later this year?
Yeah, I think, well, as Vince knows, I've said it's very hard for the Republicans to win north of the Potomac River in general. So the fact that we're so far north in Mass running a very strong campaign is really exciting. And I think it really gets back to the enthusiasm. People are really excited. Vince also talks about it, the ability of the founding fathers, kind of the check and balances. This is a perfect opportunity for people to vent and really say, listen, you know, we don't really like the way you're governing. We don't particularly like the arrogance you've shown. And, you know, just this isn't Kennedy's seat, right? This is like a seat for the state of Massachusetts, and it's not beholden to one party. And I think those combination factors, I mean, I think there's been a tremendous amount of arrogance shown by the Democrats that it was a walk in the park. The turnout is going to be incredibly low, which obviously favors any kind of insurgent candidacy. And I did some research going back to off-year elections in Massachusetts where Republicans have actually done very well, I think in large measure to the low turnout, which, you know, when you've got a very decided focus of people that want to vote, they're going to make it to the polls, and that can make a big difference on election day.
Yeah, well, Mark, I think that's a good point. Let me stick with you on this next question. There are reports now that Minority Leader John Boehner in the House of Representatives has put together a task force to develop a document that will be similar to the Contract for America that Newt Gingrich rolled out in the summer of 1994, less than about 90 days before Republicans took back the House in that election. And this seems to be headed down that same path. You know, tell us a little bit about that. What I recall from the Contract for America has had lots of popular initiatives, most of which the Republicans never actually enacted when they were in the majority.
Well, yeah. Well, the promise was that there would be 10 bills that they would introduce. The Contract for America was essentially 10 ideas. And the Republicans said, we will vote up and down on these 10 issues. They didn't guarantee passage, but they said we will address these issues. My understanding about the next kind of Contract for America 2, if you will, it's more of a blueprint for the 21st century. Once again, to be released after Labor Day, more kind of strategic policies as opposed to legislation. My understanding as well is that it's, once again, going to be very poll-driven, which, you know, isn't too surprising. Apparently, there were five pollsters that met with some of the top Republicans just these last couple days saying, here's what's happening in the field, so that's not too surprising. What I don't think too many people remember, 1994, as you talked about, obviously Labor Day was the big push-off point, but they successfully used a very creative media campaign, heavy advertising, including the TV Guide, where they basically said we're going to use, you know, kind of old-school advertising and magazines, but they ran all these very interesting paid media advertisements at the right time when people started paying attention, and that made a big difference. So I think it's going to get a lot more talk, but it'll be interesting to see what happens. I mean, obviously Labor Day is a long way away, but this is obviously a pretty good strategy, I think, to run going forward. I mean, people can resonate, 10 ideas, this is what we're going to do. It's a very easy thing to digest.
Guys, I've got about a minute left, so let me ask you real quick. Next week, the one-week anniversary of President Obama's inauguration. Give me a grade for his first year in office in one sentence that explains the grade. Vince, we'll start with you.
Okay. I'd give him a B. I think that he's been, you know, unlike some members of Congress who are not taking political risks, he is actually taking big political risks and potentially putting his own reelection in jeopardy by trying to move big pieces of things, of legislation that are going to upset people. And I think that's a risk that people haven't seen in a long time being taken by politicians.
Mark, real fast, great in a sentence.
Yeah, I would give him a B as well. I think he's been, you know, like, audacity is a key frame to Team Obama, and they've been very audacious. I mean, they're certainly not too interested in their own reelection and maintaining control on Capitol Hill. I mean, they could have taken the easy way out and worked with Republicans to pass legislation, but they seem to be working with themselves to pass a much more aggressive piece of legislation than I thought most people thought.
Although if Scott Brown does win this race, then Olympia Snowe is going to be the one that's going to decide for health care reform next month, right? Because they're going to need the 60th vote, right?
Well, we will save that discussion for next week. We'll know the answer come Tuesday. Mark, Vince, thanks for joining us. Love to have you guys back on for more later this spring or summer. We're going to be back in just a moment where we'll turn our attention to the Russian Federation here on Capital Thinking.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-
457-6000. It's all about action.
Touchdown!
Scores.
Taking a look at the NBA tonight.
Highlights.
He's broken loose. He's at the 30.
And headlines.
Big trade in the NFL this afternoon.
When you are looking to talk sports, look no further than the Voice America Sports Network. We bring you some of the biggest names and all the sports news you can handle, whether it's basketball.
Off the glass.
Football.
Come on. Finish.
Golf, racing, or the Olympics. We've got you covered. We'll even cover tailgating. Tune in to the Voice America Sports Network. It's all things sports.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Have
having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right. Well, welcome back. You know, every once in a while, we take you abroad to look at some interesting legal cases, people who are being wronged, and the folks here in the United States who are trying to right that wrong. Today, we have as our guest Kristen Johnson, a Washington, D.C. attorney who's been on the show before. Many of our frequent listeners will remember the case of Emmanuel Zeltzer from 2009. This was a gentleman and a political activist from England who had been basically kidnapped and taken to Belarus and was being held captive there, was in poor health, and through the efforts of Kristen and a team of others, Zeltzer was actually returned to his home in late 2009. And so Kristen is back to talk to us about another case, the case of Arkady Gontmaker. Kristen, welcome back to the show, and tell us a little bit. Mr. Gontmaker is an American from the state of Washington and a Jewish-Ukrainian immigrant, and tell us a little bit about his situation.
Sure. Thank you, Kevin. Arkady Gontmaker is an American citizen, but he did originally come from the Ukraine. He resides or has resided in Bellevue, Washington for many years, and it was involved in the fishing business. He owned a fishing company that specialized in king crabs primarily and distributed those throughout the United States. He traveled from the U.S. over to Russia, where he frequently traveled to attend, I believe, a fisherman's conference of sorts, and was picked up in September 20th to be precise, of 2007, by the authorities there and put in prison. The investigators over there have alleged several charges against him, the primary charge being overfishing, saying that he knew about some overfishing that was occurring in off the coast of Russia. So that's basically the background of where he is, and he remains there today. No trial has been set in this case.
Let me ask you about that, because I know from the information that came in before we did the show, Russian law, you can the Russian law says if you're going to be in pretrial detention, we've got to get you to trial in 18 months. It's obviously reminiscent of the constitutional protections that we afford citizens for their right to a speedy trial, and that many other civilized nations across the world do as well. And obviously, the Russian Federation has that that same type of provision. So I guess by my count, he's been in jail almost 30 months.
28 months, yeah.
Yeah. So what exactly is happening? What's the delay?
Well, let me clarify that law a little bit, and something that maybe our listeners might not be aware of. In Eastern European judicial system is a little bit different than we're used to in the United States, in that during an initial investigation into a crime, the matter is tied up with the Ministry of the Interior. It's actually not with the Ministry of Justice until the courts take it over, and the courts don't take it over until it's out of this quote-unquote pre-trial investigatory phase, and that has carried on. It just ended in December, but it has carried on from September 2007 to the present. And the law that you're referencing is a law that actually governs the investigator's ability to detain an individual while they're carrying on the investigation. And it basically says, you know, you have to have very specific reasons as to why you need to keep someone in jail. And in this case, those reasons certainly don't seem to be there. The thought that someone will go and continue their crime if they're let out, or it will constitute some sort of serious offense or danger to society. But regardless, the investigators justify his detention, and they continue to extend it. So procedural law in Russia has a cap, a maximum cap of 18 months that anyone should ever be held in pretrial detention. And this case is unique because in this instance, the investigators have seemed to completely disregard the rule of law there and kept him in pretrial detention for the entire investigatory period, which took approximately 27 months. And now he's still
in detention. That's a heck of a fishing expedition, pardon the pun. into his case. What are his rights while he's there? Is he able to meet regularly with you and his outside counsel? Does he get to communicate with his family? I mean, how is he being treated?
Well, he's fully detained. It's my understanding it's a full security prison that he's in, and he does have regular access by the U.S. consulate over there. The Department of State and the embassy has been highly engaged in this case, particularly as it's carried on significantly far past this 18 months, which, I mean, the 18-month limit was intended to keep the most dangerous of criminals off the street, not individuals who are businessmen and potentially or allegedly involved in overfishing. I also should mention that the crime of overfishing in Russia carries a maximum penalty of 2 years. So
he's already served...
He served his time, but he's still there, so... We question as to why, you know, why the Russian government seems to have taken such keen interest in this successful businessman who was successful in the United States and obviously had some ties to Eastern Europe, being from the Ukraine originally.
Well, what is the Russian government saying about this situation, and what does international law sort of say to the Russians should be done here?
The Russian government is not saying much. The embassy has, well, let me back up a little bit, because there have been some recent developments, and maybe that will help explain what the Russian government has been doing. I mentioned that this case went from an investigation period into a trial period. That happened in the middle of December, where the investigators submitted the case to the courts there. And in connection with that, when the court, the Moscow City Court, received the case from the investigators, the Moscow City Court said, you know what, we don't actually have jurisdiction over this. 27 months in the making, you're giving it to us, and we don't want to have this case because you're talking about fishing that occurred 2,500 miles to the east of Moscow in an area called the Kamchatka Peninsula. So the court actually rejected the case, rejected asserting jurisdiction over the case, and has requested that the court in Kamchatka receive the case. The Kamchatka court has not yet received the case, so the case is in a little bit of a limbo now. But in the meantime, the court, the Moscow City Court, that says it doesn't have jurisdiction, has extended Arkady's detention until June of this year, and no trial date is set. It doesn't look like one will be set anytime soon, and we don't have any hope that that date would be the end date for the detention. And so the embassy has met with the Russian government multiple times, questioning in many different ways how this is justified, and frankly, we're not getting a good response from the government.
Sure, and I know he's a Jewish immigrant, so I guess my question is, in the international community, have you been able to rally to his defense any sort of you know, Ukrainian groups or any Jewish groups or any just human rights activists to sort of help you guys plead your case in Russia?
I know that there has been some voice concern by the Jewish community, especially in Seattle. Congresspersons from Washington have also taken interest in the case and written letters to the State Department and to President Obama requesting for his release, given the extremely long time that he's been in jail, kind of without justification. So there has been some interest. I think the longer this goes on, the more awareness will be raised over it. One thing interesting about this case is you haven't seen it on the news very much, and Mr. Gontmakher is not necessarily your heart-wrenching story of, you know, a mother with two kids who got thrown in jail because she was reporting on a human rights issue. He's someone who is just a businessman and doesn't necessarily pick up the public's attention quite as much as some other stories might. But the bottom line is that this man's human rights have been egregiously violated by being held arbitrarily in detention for over 2 years without a trial date in sight for a crime that, frankly, he's already served the maximum sentence of.
Very, very interesting.
I
know in the past when you had something like the Zeltzer case, you were working not only through the embassy but also with groups like the UN. So are you pressuring official organs of the international community as well to look into violations of international law or to work with the Russian Federation to say, hey, you know, he's already spent more time in jail than if he'd actually been convicted of the crime?
Yeah, we are considering working with the UN on this one. We haven't initiated a complaint yet. He did file a complaint with the European Court of Human Rights. I don't recall exactly when that was, but it was a while back. The problem is the European Court of Rights just takes a very long time to resolve any issues. And so even though he ultimately may receive a judgment in his favor, whether that will have any real practical effect on his case is highly uncertain. And the Russian government, I should also note, according to the State Department, very rarely abides by certain of its judgments that come down from the European Court of Human Rights, finding particularly procedural and detention-related violations of international law. So there's not a lot of hope, really, when you're appealing to the international community and or the international legal bodies here, because enforcement is basically for want.
I've got to wrap up here, Kristen, but Sure. Tell us sort of your next step here real quickly.
Right now, we are pursuing diplomatic channels pretty heavily. The fact that Arkady is essentially in a jurisdictional limbo right now gives us a strong window of opportunity to call for his release. I know that the Minister of Justice in Russia is aware of this case, and now that it is with the courts, technically, it might give us an opportunity to appeal to the Minister of Justice's sense of rule of law. And
all
really,
right, well, Kristen, we're going to have
really
to cut it off there.
Release.
We'll have you back to talk about Mr. Gontmakher's case as circumstances warrant. We'll be back in just a minute.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Markets up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hola. Konnichiwa.
Bonjour.
Hello.
From Anchorage to Abu Dhabi.
Merhaba.
From Denver to
Hello.
Doha.
Ciao.
Patton Boggs makes
Ni-ha.
Business transactions the world over.
Oi.
Rely on our insights for your next deal. Patton Boggs, the international business team. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The
business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio. Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, well, welcome back to the show. Many of us woke up on Christmas morning, and after we were done opening presents, we turned on the news to discover there was a suspected terrorist attack on a flight to Detroit that implicated our Homeland Security system again, and subsequent investigations have pointed out lots of places where we could improve our security. We wanted to delve into some of the ways that America is working to improve its security, and our guests today are Scott Thompson, who's a public policy lawyer in Washington, D.C., and Brooke Miller, who's a vice president for Smith's Detection. That's one of the world's leaders in making homeland security products. Brooke, I know you all, I just spent yesterday flying coast to coast and running through the machines for the first time since the bombing, and I wanted to have you tell us a little bit about Smith's Detection and where I see your products out there in the homeland security world when I'm passing through an airport or elsewhere here in the United States.
Sure, Kevin. Good afternoon to you. Briefly, Smith's Detection is one of five divisions of a larger engineering group called Smith's Group. It's a British-based, engineering outfit with most of its divisions actually headquartered here in the United States. It is a very global company in terms of its research and development activities and its markets and manufacturing and service facilities all over the world. About half of our employees and operations and so forth are spread through about 40 states here in the United States. Smith's Detection itself is about an $800 million a year business, making it sort of the big dog, if you will, in the homeland security detection marketplace. Our next competitor is about half our size in terms of revenues. We are, again, we have a very, very global reach, so we're represented and we get information throughout the world, which helps our approach to R&D and the like. And we are known for a variety of things, but maybe most visibly is the breadth of detection equipment that we design and manufacture and service, from radiological and chemical and biological detection gear to narcotic and explosive equipment, X-ray systems of mailrooms, small mailroom size, to those huge things you see in ports that are scanning entire containers and trucks and the like. And pretty much everything in between. We touch certainly the aviation markets around the world. We're probably in 85% of the world's markets. We supply the U.S. military with chemical detectors. We work with the ports and borders authorities around the world, emergency responders, mass transit agencies, and critical infrastructure and the like. So.
Well, Brooke, I want to talk a little bit about, I know you all obviously partner closely with the Department of Homeland Security, and I want to talk a little bit about these body scanners. I know you all have what's called advanced imaging technology, AIT equipment, that you've been working with DHS on to sort of integrate that technology into airport checkpoints to improve transportation security. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure can. We do indeed engage very actively with all the components of DHS, in particular TSA, and these had until recently been called whole body imagers, or AIT now, have been around in a variety of forms for 4 or 5 years or so. And they've really been, the TSA with industry have been working to tweak them and develop them further so that they really bring a whole different dimension to checkpoint security, really addressing individual screening, i.e. suicide bombers, is where they really saw the threat developing a number of years ago. And you may remember the puffer machines that had been around some years ago. It was at that time where that generation of puffer machines was being determined by TSA that it wasn't as useful as they had hoped in the airport checkpoint environment. At the same time, where the bad guys were coming up with different types of explosive devices that really didn't need metal in order to contain or detonate them, which rendered sort of a different position on the metal detectors, which have been omnipresent in checkpoints. And at the same time, where this millimeter wave or backscatter technology, whole body scanning technology, was coming to a level of maturity that really caught their interest. And so they started to develop them. We were part of that. We work with a technology called millimeter wave, which is not far. It's being evaluated now in their Atlantic City Tech Center. Soon to be out in the field for evaluation, and then we hope and fully expect it to be approved for purchase and deployment out in the U.S. airport environment.
Scott, let me turn to you now. We mentioned at the top of the segment, obviously everybody sort of got back into this bunker mentality on airport security after the Christmas Day attack or attempted attack there on the flight to Detroit. And I know we've just sort of walked through with Brooke some of the different types of technology that are under development and consideration at TSA that folks like Smith Detection is working on. Smith has this Echo AIT system, and I'm wondering how effective that would have been in a case like what just happened in Detroit, where you've got somebody trying to sneak on their person plastic explosive in a fairly small amount, on their body.
It would have increased the chances significantly of that detection occurring, Kevin. And what AIT technology does in a system like the Echo is to look for anomalies on the body, just kind of like the anomaly of the PETN plastic explosive compound that occurred in the Northwest Airlines attack. The question, though, is whether the personnel viewing and looking for that anomaly would have for sure caught it in this case. The alleged terrorist was certainly crafty in trying to make it as difficult to detect as possible, but the problem here is we never got to that point because the whole body scanners that are in place, actually, ironically enough, in the Amsterdam airport, were not used in this case because the Nigerian was transferring through the transit hall and did not go through the AIT equipment that Amsterdam actually has. So there's a question here of deployment to get that technology out there in enough places to not only increase detection but increase deterrence. And that said, what we do know is that conventional metal detectors would not have detected the plastic explosive like the PETN compound in this case because they're not metal. And not only does that apply to on-body plastic explosives, but things like ceramic knives and other types of weapons that terrorists are increasingly using to try to outwit what is increasingly outdated technology in metal detection. So what we in Smith call for is a multi-layered approach that combines these AIT whole-body imaging systems to look for those kinds of anomalies with things like trace detection, where you swab someone to look for explosive particles on that person, such as this PETN compound. Because those particles are sticky, you can swab and detect them that way as part of a multi-layered attempt to find what you need to find in aviation security.
Now, Brooke, let me come back to you. I know DHS obviously is gearing up to respond to these types of challenges. You know, for people who can remember after 9/11, when DHS was first formed, there was a great deal of emphasis on improving the screening of checked baggage, which was a multi-billion-dollar investment that had to be made to put in these very large systems in the checked baggage area. And now, obviously, this threat and the 9/11 threat were people who were bringing weapons directly onto flights or explosives onto flight to the flights, not putting them in the cargo hold. So, how is DHS thinking of what it'll do to procure the next generation of detection equipment, and are you all sort of together on which technologies are likely to provide our best level of protection at the airport?
Kevin, we believe we are. We work very collaboratively with different parts of DHS, science and technology, and TSA in particular, on understanding the threats and what their understanding of those threats and how to combat them are, and that's been going on quite effectively for several years now. You know, these AIT systems have been in the plan both in their deployment plan and also their budget for several years now, I think a little over 2 years. And so I don't think that this instance, while it may accelerate and expand the planned deployments that have been around for a bit of time now somewhat, they'll pretty much stick with their plan because they understand the threat. They find this a very useful tool to help combat this particular incident or type of incident, and we don't really anticipate a huge variation in what they were planning to do anyway. Right now, there are about 2,300 checkpoints in the United States aviation system, and their plan is to deploy 800 of these types of systems into those airports by 2014. So it's something in the order of a third of the checkpoints that they're planning to supply these systems with. Again, that may be accelerated somewhat given the latest instance.
Well, let me ask you, we've got just time for sort of one more question here. I know a great deal of controversy in the minds of some people in Congress when you get into this next generation of technology is the ability to balance security and privacy and what some of these scanners can and can't show. So talk to me a little bit about how you're balancing the concern between privacy and security, Brooke.
Sure. Obviously, it's an omnipresent concern and a very, very important one. And both industry and I think the government within DHS has taken it very seriously and done quite a number of things to help lessen the concern about it. I'll catalog a handful of either technology or operational measures that they've taken in order to put people's minds at ease. Maybe the first one is education. I think that the government needs to do a better job of educating people on the nature of the technology and what they're really doing, what they're not doing, and so forth. And they will continue to get better at that. They do sort of electronic things such as facial blurring. Digitally, they simply blur out the face, so you really cannot tell who the individual is. Another step is sort of a curious term called figure or body normalization, which electronically they attempt to make all people look a little bit more the same in terms of their image quality. They have remote viewing with a secure line between the checkpoint and the operator who's actually doing the scanning review. It is an optional process, again, which I think TSA needs to be more communicative about, that it's simply an option. If people are uncertain or concerned about that type of technology, they can raise their hand and go off for a pat down or a trace detection, or however the TSA chooses to give them that option. There are prospects for automated detection coming up in the coming months. Maybe this year we'll see automated detection capabilities with the system. So basically, a computer is making that determination if there is an anomaly on a person. And maybe most importantly, the operational and field machines would have no capacity or capability to save, store, print those images. So they are erased immediately before the next person comes into the screening area. The prior image is necessarily deleted and gone forever. So there are a number of, I think there's smart and prudent things, and a big part of it is educating people so that they become accustomed as to exactly what's going on with it.
Interesting. Well, I appreciate that explanation. I think that does put a lot of folks at ease to know that the extent to which their privacy is being protected in this process to make us all safe. Well, Scott and Brooke, I'm going to have to wrap things up there. Very much appreciate it. Wish you good luck in your working with the Department of Homeland Security and the Congress in rolling this technology out for the benefit of us all. And we'd love to have you guys back on at a later date to talk some more about this issue. We'll be back in just a moment with the hot political stories of the day.
Markets up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back to the show. Always an interesting show. Loved having the guys on from Smith Detection talking about the very topical question of when we are going to put in next generation technology and what that technology is capable of doing in terms of protecting us at the airports and whatnot. I certainly am a strong proponent of putting the best technology in there and making sure we err on the side of security. And it looks like they've got a good balance between security and privacy. So it'll be interesting to see the rollout of that and whether or not the Al-Qaeda's of the world choose to make another bombing run at us here in the near future. Well, we're going to talk about some quick political stories. Obviously, the president very challenged this week, now having to deal with the crisis in Haiti, what looks to be the worst humanitarian crisis of at least a generation. They're talking hundreds of thousands potentially dead, and in a country that has woeful infrastructure already in place to deal day-to-day with their citizens, to have this sort of devastation occur. You're talking about years to decades to rebuild, and you're also talking, sadly, probably about a situation where the lack of infrastructure and resources means a lot of people that are trapped in the rubble may not be rescued in time here in the next critical day or two while we still have a chance to get them out. Got to applaud the United States government, the president, with a firm response today with his national security team, Secretary of State, Homeland Security, and Vice President, among others on hand, talking about the forces that we will deploy on behalf of the Haitian people to help them. And certainly we will be the tip of what's a worldwide iceberg, but nobody reaches out like the United States of America to help in a time of crisis like this. And given the large number of Haitian Americans, certainly it's even more tangibly important to Americans that we reach out and help here. So if you haven't already donated to a charitable cause, the Red Cross, or somebody else who's on the ground, you know, think about doing that this week. They're in desperate need of cots and blankets and food and water, and the best thing you can do is make a credit card contribution to one of those credible charities and let them use that money to buy some supplies and get the supplies and folks on the ground to help out right away. Let's talk about politics. We talked at the opening of the show about that exciting race up in Massachusetts. And I think the Republicans have already won. Even if they don't win that race, the fact of the matter is Democratic Party and some of their allies, labor unions and other interest groups, are now in, pouring a couple $1 million into that race this week to make sure that they can pull out a victory. That's money they won't have to spend on critical races across the country later this year. And anything, losing by single digits, will be a moral victory for Republicans and will send alarm bells through the offices of many moderate Democrats up for re-election in 2010. On the off chance Scott Brown actually pulls off this election in Massachusetts, boy, you will really see the wheels come off the bus of much of the Democratic legislative agenda here in 2010. Not only would that mean that there wouldn't be a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate anymore for President Obama and his agenda, but you would just, again, Massachusetts, very Democratic state. You see something like that happen in a very Democratic state, you have to think a lot of blue dog Democrats in the House and a handful of moderate Democrats in the Senate really start to fundamentally rethink their position of support on a lot of controversial issues, be it cap and trade legislation, financial reform, and perhaps most importantly here in the short term, health care reform. That health care reform vote is going to take place after this vote in Massachusetts on Tuesday. It'll be very interesting to see what happens. We talked a little bit about President Obama was also on the TV this morning talking about a new proposed fee that he's going to impose on banks as a way to recoup some of the money that we gave to them to, in the TARP program and to bail them out. Very interesting that the president continues to beat the drum on a sort of class warfare against Wall Street and the bankers there as a way to assure the public he's not closely tied to Wall Street. There's a huge public discontent with Wall Street, the way it's operated, the way it's been regulated, the way it's made money, and the way it's paying out record bonuses this year. The president and his economic team have been working closely with those folks so that he could bail them out in the first year of his administration, but he doesn't want to be tainted by them, and he clearly doesn't like how much they're getting paid. So he's going to impose a tax in the hope that that sort of puts the brakes on what their executives are getting paid. What I never understand when the president proposes this tax or some of the taxes that he's proposed in the health care reform world or in cap and trade world is I've never seen a scenario where they say that, where they've drawn it up where the company isn't going to just simply turn around and put that tax into the cost of the goods and services that the consumers pay for. I certainly think that that's what would happen here. As a shareholder in the banks, I want the banks to maximize their profits. I don't want them to say, oh, sure, we don't want to make as much money as we've made in the past. That's where I really don't understand the disconnect. It also strikes me that striking out at bonuses again and again from the White House smacks a lot of class envy, and that type of class warfare is exactly the sort of thing that we were told the Obama administration would not do, wouldn't be pitting various groups against one another. And that's a little bit disappointing. We're reaching a critical point in health care reform. President Obama met with union leaders earlier this week to talk about their dissatisfaction with the proposed plan on Cadillac health benefit plans, type of plans that unions have typically negotiated for in collective bargaining agreements in lieu of higher wages, and they're worried about their members being taxed on that. Looks like there might be a deal for those those entities to not have to pay a tax if that health care benefit plan was collectively bargained. To me, that seems like the exact same sort of class warfare I just mentioned. I can't believe that the president will be able to sell effectively to the American people this idea that some of us who have a health care plan that's valued at $25,000 for a family of four will have to pay taxes on that, and some of us won't have to pay taxes, and the determining factor will be if you were a member of a union that collectively bargained that. I think there'll be lots of white-collar workers, private employers around the country who will say that's fundamentally unfair, and I think if that is actually the deal that is cut, I think there'll be a lot of political problems there. So we'll see if that works out. There's still lots going on, lots of pieces missing, and I think in the next few days we're going to see the framework of a deal get finalized so they can send the bill off to be scored so that the Congress can be told how much it can cost, and then they'll start the process of moving it through both chambers for a final vote. We're going to be back next week. Enjoy the NFL playoffs this Sunday. We wish the Colts good luck on Saturday night. And we will see you next Thursday with another episode of Capital Thinking.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program, brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.